It is another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. I'm going to have to be completely honest. Last night, I didn't watch a single second of the Vikings and Niners Monday Night Football game. Not a single second, because my attention was glued to Game 7 of the American League Championship Series, the All-Texas ALCS between the Texas Rangers and the Houston Astros. So, no, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you all and say I have tons of notes on the Niners and Vikings. I didn't watch it. I didn't watch anything but highlights this morning. And it seemed to be a pretty thrilling game, and maybe later on in the week we'll do more of a deep dive and maybe now what's next for the Niners, a team that once looked unbeatable, has lost back-to-back games to the Browns and a backup quarterback and a struggling Vikings team without Justin Jefferson. So maybe it's a different direction time now for the Niners. Seems like the Eagles are the front runners for the number one seed in the NFC. And on the AFC side, of course, the Kansas City Chiefs. But this is a baseball segment. Last night was thrilling for me. And no, the game was not close. The Rangers came out and completely decimated the ace of the Houston Astros and Christian Javier. Now, maybe if you're an Astros fan, you have different feelings about who the ace really is. Maybe it's Justin Verlander. No, maybe it's Framber Valdez. Valdez wasn't great in the postseason. JV was. But I always thought Christian Javier was kind of that ace. Had ace stuff. Was really good last year. I don't think the best this year, but I would definitely trust Christian Javier in a Game 7 situation. And for the Rangers, they turned to a first-ballot Hall of Famer in Max Scherzer. Now, Max Scherzer was making only his second start since September, so the leash was never going to be that long. But if you were gearing up to watch that game last night, you're not hoping for anything more. Game 7, I will put up against anything in sports. This can be NBA or MLB. Game 7 is just different because unlike the other sports... No, the NCAA tournament is my favorite postseason type of festivity, if you will. March Madness is unbeatable. Baseball is my favorite sport. March Madness is unbeatable. But March Madness, I think, gets a little bit less exciting. It's crazy. I can't believe I'm saying this. But once you get past the first weekend, you lose a lot of interest from everybody. Because once your team is out, you're done watching. Like, the first weekend in the NCAA tournament is unbeatable. It's unmatched. There's so much basketball on. It's all day. And it's do or die every single game. But then after that, it's still do or die. But you're not always getting maybe the upsets you were looking for. And I'm not saying game sevens are always upsets. I mean, last night it was technically an upset. But not in the way you see in the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. So, like, peak postseason sports for me, first weekend of the NCAA tournament. Just chaos, exhilarating fun. But in terms of, I guess, what's on the line and what it takes to get to that point, I put Game 7 up to anything. Because in the NCAA tournament, right, you got to win against different teams. Okay, or in the NFL, you're winning against different teams to get to the Super Bowl. Game 7 is so hard to get to. Like, the Phillies tonight are in Game 7 against Arizona. It's the first time in their 140-year history they've ever played in a Game 7. So it's unlikely. You take two teams, they bounce back and forth between where they're playing. And the Astros, prior to last night, three games at home. Texas, three games at home. Texas was 0-3 at home. Houston was 0-3 at home. So these two teams did the unlikely and now face the Game 7, which is why I think it's that much more exhilarating. It's hard. The probability is not in favor of game sevens in sports because that's two teams being completely even after six matchups. We didn't see any game five elimination series in the ALDS, the NLDS. There were sweeps in the wild card. It was largely uneventful. But last night I'm clearing my schedule. I'm clearing my calendar. I'm watching game seven. Because they just don't happen that often. And for the teams that were put in there, I mean, the animosity, Texas and Houston, the benches that already cleared in the series, and then we get this matchup. And what I saw Texas do in the first inning was the most alpha move I had seen from a baseball team in 2023. Game 7, your back was against the wall in Game 6. You hold the Astros to 2 runs in that game and explode for 6 in the 9th. You win 9-2. Now, the Astros are feeling mentally like maybe they just can't win at home. And the Rangers cemented that fact in the first inning. They chased Javier with 1 out in the first. You want to talk about announcing your presence with authority, showing how ready you are for Game 7? I mean, to me, that was the equivalent of a heavyweight boxing match and putting somebody's ass on the ground in the first round. Just a haymaker. Now, that boxer gets up, and they still go for 9 rounds, to make this analogy fit with baseball. But they never fully recovered from that first inning blow. Corey Seager hits one to the second deck in right center field, and then just moving him around the bases. Put the coin in, it's a merry-go-round. Now, Garcia drives in a run. I believe Jonah Heim drove in a run. And it's 3-0, and they could have done a lot more damage. It was first and third. They put in Phil Maton, Dusty Baker, that is, put in Phil Maton for Christian Javier, and he got out of it. And I thought to myself for a second, boy, that could be huge. The Rangers in the first inning could have ended that one. 5-0, 6-0, this game's over. You're not hanging 7 or 8 runs on the Rangers pitching staff, especially with the way their starters had been rolling. And no, Scherzer wasn't great in his first start in Game 3. But I always knew the leash was short. And Bruce Bochy, a very established manager, I don't believe has lost a Game 7. He turned to 2 guys, or was looking to turn to 2 guys in the rotation last night. Went to Jordan Montgomery and had Andrew Heaney warming up in the bullpen. So they were pulling out all the stops to try and close that game out early. When you have that stacked against you in a 5-6 run deficit, it's impossible to overcome. And then we saw the Astros show some fight. It was 4-2, and Yordan Alvarez had tripled. And you think, uh-oh, you know, you get Alvarez home, and it's a 1-run game in Game 7. Crowd turns on you. This could get out of hand for Texas now. But, man, they shut everybody up a few innings later. Evan Carter. I don't know why I keep saying Evan White. Evan Carter had a 2-run double that, to me, iced that game. A 21-year-old who did not play the full season in Texas. He was a 2020 draft pick, a second rounder, I might add, and he's playing on the biggest stage. Just turned 21, I might add. 2-run double, and then the floodgates just opened up. Garcia homered twice last night. He had the solo shot to right field to make it 4-1, and then later on, and the Crawford boxes, the Crawford seats in left field. I mean, they were kind of wall scrapers, but he's just got that gargantuan type of strength that he can muscle any ball out of the ballpark. And then Nate Lowe with the cherry on top, and the Rangers went on to win 11-4 and moved to their first World Series since 2011, looking to avenge that team that was a strike away multiple times against the Cardinals. But we all remember that David Freese series as the Cardinals went on to win Game 7 against the Houston Astros. You know, I really did digest a lot last night when trying to think of the words to describe this Texas team and why I firmly believe they're so good for baseball. There was, I think, going back to 2000. And Moneyball, as we brought up many times on the show, Moneyball is a fantastic movie. And it's a true story. Now, some things are Hollywoodified, if you want to say it like that. You know, there's some things that just simply were exaggerated a bit. You know, I always think it's funny that one of my favorite scenes in the movie, the trade deadline, it makes it seem like the A's are cleaning house, they're terrible. They were very much in the hunt at that point. No, they were still playing very well before the deadline. Like, there's some things that were drug on a little bit to make the movie better, and I'm not going to fault them for that decision. You can't make everything completely accurate, or else you may lose the interest in the audience. So I understand why Moneyball did that. But what Moneyball did, I feel like, back then in the real world, and when the movie came out in the early 2010s, is that it made everybody think, whether they had before or they had not, that you can build a winner by not spending any money. You can, you know, bargain shop, if you will. You can scrape off the bottom of the barrel, find guys that nobody's paying attention to, and build a 100-win baseball team. But what a lot of people don't understand about Moneyball, at least maybe I'm over-exaggerating here and saying many people, I would say some people don't understand, that A's team was still ridiculously loaded. They had an MVP in Miguel Tejada. They had Eric Chavez. They had Barry Zito. They had Tim Hudson. Like, it was a loaded group. Now, there were some guys that were quote-unquote moneyballed, but Chad Bradford, of course, Scott Hatteberg, David Justice. There were guys that were definitely cheap pickups. But we can always remember at the end of the movie what happened. Well, they won 100-plus games and lost to the Twins, and another Game 5 elimination game in the ALDS. The year before, they had lost to the Yankees. Now, the Yankees, much more than the Twins, they spent money to go out there and win a lot of their World Series championships in the late 90s and the 2000s. And I think for the better part of 2010 to 2020, when you saw teams that lost 100-plus games, when you saw 110-game losers, every time the fix for that team is, well, you lost 110, you really got to rebuild. Now, it's a bad team, wait around 3 to 4 years, take the money ball approach, don't spend a lot of money, find talent where nobody's looking, and build a winner through that outlet. And we had seen Arizona, who's in Game 7 tonight. We had seen Baltimore lose 110-plus. And we saw Texas 2 years ago lose 102. And I would say that Arizona and Baltimore are much different than Texas. Texas, to me, has always had the resource of going out and spending. They just never had the right manager. I mean, Chris Woodward was just not the fit that Bruce Bochy is. I mean, Chris Young coming in as a GM had a different aggression to him. And to me, that's what a lot of teams are missing. Where we saw Baltimore this year shock the baseball world. They won 101 games, and many of their players, I don't think, are noticeable to the average baseball fan. I mean, if you could tell me in length about Anthony Santander, I would give you some credit. Or Jorge Mateo, or Ryan Mountcastle, Austin Hayes. Now, of course, you know Gunnar Henderson, Natalie Rutschman now, and Grayson Rodriguez, but you may not know Tyler Wells. You may know Felix Bautista, but you don't know Buddy Baumann. I mean, the Baltimore Orioles were a team that just didn't spend a lot of money. They were low in payroll this year, but they won 101. And what happened? Well, the team that spent $500-plus million last offseason and more money this offseason to bring in Jacob DeGrom, get Nathan Eovaldi, add to the bullpen, trade for Scherzer at the deadline, it was that team that swept Baltimore out of the playoffs. Which is why, to me, Texas is great for baseball. Texas just showed a lot of people out there that, in, you know, the Mets were a terrible example this year of, they spent a lot of money, were number one in payroll, and they didn't even make the postseason. But that should never stop teams from trying to spend. Because what Chris Young did is he came in, and that's former Royal Chris Young, if you're not aware, the 2015 6'10" pitcher Chris Young, the Princeton man. He came into Arlington and said, we're not rebuilding. I'm not going to sit around here for 5 years losing 95 games, 90, 88, only in the hopes of being a postseason wild card team by 2026 or 2027. When Chris Young took over, the first thing he wanted to do was solidify the middle infield. Gave boatloads of money to Corey Seager and Marcus Semien. And we could go way, way back, and I remember when that signing happened. And I feel like I remember the most part of that show. And I said, this is either going to blow up in their face and look really stupid because Semien's over 30, Seager's going to be over 30, and you're paying them till they're like 37, 38, and 39. You're not going to get the best version of those guys when they're that old. But Texas understood this. If we are going to outbid the Dodgers, the Yankees, hell, maybe the Angels, West Coast, the Mets, the Phillies. If we're going to outbid them, we need to make it known that we're all right giving you that type of money when you're in your late 30s. Maybe those other teams weren't. But the reason I said it's either going to work or blow up in their face is if the Texas Rangers win the World Series this year, that contract is forever worth it. It is. Even if he struggles, Seager, or if he struggles, Semien, when he's 35, 36, 37, the contract is still worth it because you got a title out of it. And you don't get that title if you don't give them those type of contracts. And they've been fantastic for the Rangers. These first 2 years, phenomenal. They may not be the same 4 years later. Who knows if they're still on the Rangers 4 years later. But if they win it, it's worth it. And Chris Young took on that identity of, we're going to be so aggressive in free agency that we're just throwing money at big-name guys. And you may scoff at, man, the Rangers aren't ready to compete. They don't have the rotation. Well, I thought the Rangers got the offense last year when losing 90-plus games. And I'm sure people were laughing at the Rangers going, look at that. You spent $500-plus million. They also added John Gray last year to help their rotation, to give him a number one, and he wasn't really a number one. But they spent all that money. And what did Chris Young do? He didn't backpedal and go, oh, that was a bad decision. And we're still a ways away. We need to draft well. We need to have these trades that can help us. And they made a lot of trades that helped them. Odolis Garcia may be the headliner in trading cash considerations a few years back. And then DFAing him and him clearing waivers. And now he's the ALCS MVP. I mean, moves like that sometimes are just luck. But what did Chris Young do in the offseason? Well, we need pitching. DeGrom, Eovaldi, Heaney. Then you add Scherzer at the deadline. They never operated this year. Going back to last November, they never operated worrying about 2024. They never operated worrying about 2025 or 2026. Chris Young took a 100-plus loss team and said, we're going to win now. I'm not looking to 2025 and 2026 because what do we know about baseball? It's unpredictable. You can never firmly predict what is going to happen 2 years from now. You can't. You don't know who's going to be great. You don't know who's going to have a superstar. You don't know what free agency is going to look like. Trades are going to happen. You don't know any of that. So what's the best thing you can do? Try to win now if you can. And for years, teams were scared to do what the Rangers were doing, because they'd seen so many teams before them fail, spend a lot of money, and get bounced in the first round or not make the postseason. But what last night showed to me is that spending money is the only reason the Rangers outlasted the Astros. Now, there were great trades they made, and I would say a bulk of their roster came via trade. You know, Leody Taveras, adding that to your outfield. Odolis Garcia, adding that to that outfield. You know, Jonah Heim behind the plate. There were some big moves they made. I mean, the Chapman move as well to the Royals. Now they gave up Cole Reagans, but when you make it to the World Series, I don't think it really matters because the Royals lost 106, and I still like the trade for the Royals, but I also like the trade for the Rangers. That was good for baseball last night. If the Rangers would have lost in six and lost four straight to Houston, well, we would have all seen Houston in the World Series yet again without making any significant moves in the offseason. They just continue to have this same core. But it wouldn't have changed baseball again. Baseball's forever changing. You know, there's going to come another team like the Oakland A's, the Moneyball A's, that get far in the postseason without spending money, and teams are going to try to emulate that. I mean, hell, tonight, if Arizona makes the World Series, guess what it does? It changes baseball once more because the Diamondbacks lost more games than the Rangers 2 years ago and then just steadily improved, drafted really well, built around a young core and traded for other young pieces. Didn't break their backs in free agency, which is why I'm rooting for an Arizona-Texas World Series now. I want to see two completely different ends of the spectrum and how you built a winner. But you look at a team like the Royals to tie this in. The Royals don't spend any money. And if Philly wins tonight, maybe it does tell somebody like John Sherman. It tells somebody like J.J. Piccolo. Maybe in the end, we don't have to wait around three more years to build a winner. I mean, Texas didn't have the most loaded system 2 years ago. They were kind of just stuck in the mud. Bad pitching, not a lot of talent offensively, and they bought two big-time middle infielders, got a star at third base in Josh Young, added Nathaniel Lowe, who was hanging on with the Rays, added Jonah Heim, completely rebuilt the rotation, a lot of money put in. And Rangers fans, as tortured as they were for the entire 2010s, you know, after that World Series loss to St. Louis, it all kind of feels worth it now that you have a GM and an owner that are willing to do that for the fan base. New stadium, bringing a new team. And I saw last night, Royals fans were envious to see somebody like Texas, who 2 years ago was in a worse spot than you, record-wise. I mean, Texas lost 14 more games than the Royals did in 2021. Now look 2 years later. You know, maybe the Royals are looking at Arizona and saying, that's the most likely rebuild for us. We can revamp that bullpen, add an ace to the staff, make a couple of trades here and there to pair with Bobby Witt Jr. and Garcia and Pasquantino and Cole Reagans, and we can win 80-plus games next year and then get to the postseason the year after. Like I said in baseball, you can't predict anything. The Royals could also lose 100-plus next year. I'm not going to firmly cement anything until I see what the roster looks like. But Texas, to me, shows a lot of people out there. I mean, the way they hammered Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay never spends. They have never spent any money. They can't fill the stands, and they just go off scouting. They're very good at scouting. They won 90-plus games with a very low payroll. Baltimore, very low payroll, won 100-plus games. Who are the teams sitting at home on the couch and watching the Texas Rangers? The team that didn't spend a lot of money. That tells you something about the American League. You don't need this extraneous rebuild, this 5 to 7 year rebuild. You don't need that. If you have an owner that's willing to invest, you can go spend a lot of money. And you can build a winner, a competitive bunch. And I think for Royals fans last night, you're going, why not us? Yes, we are smaller in terms of market size than the Rangers. They've got a brand new shiny stadium. And in the great state of Texas, and an owner that wants to spend that much money, and the Royals aren't really near that. But you just had to dream a little bit. I mean, what would happen if the Royals spent $500 million additional payroll this year? What would happen? How much better would they look? Can you look 2 years down the road and see the Royals in the World Series again? A lot of you, including myself, are going to go, no, I can't. Because I've never seen the Royals do what the Rangers did. I think they're good for baseball. Happy for Chris Young. I did not want to see the Astros in the World Series again. But last night, as I said, baseball's forever changing. It's not going to be stuck in one way forever. We fell in love with teams like the Rays getting in the World Series in the COVID year. We fell in love with teams like Arizona this postseason. And you look at all the teams that spent a ton of money on the National League side. The Padres, the Dodgers, the Mets. They're not in the World Series. They're not in the National League Championship Series. But on the American League side, we've seen Texas spend all that money and now get to a World Series. So it's always going to change. You're going to hate it when somebody spends all the money and doesn't make it, or you're going to love it. Like I'm sure a lot of Texas fans are loving it this morning following their 11-4 win in Game 7 of the American League Championship Series. They now await the winner of tonight's game between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Arizona Diamondbacks, who forced a Game 7 last night after winning 5-1 on the road. For the D-backs tonight, they will throw Brandon Pfaadt on the mound, the rookie for Arizona, against Ranger Suarez, who has just been elite in the postseason for Philadelphia with his 0.64 ERA. First pitch, 7:07 p.m. Central Time, and you can listen to that over on Sports Radio 810 WHB. We're going to take our first break of the show. When we come back, some news that I heard on the Border Patrol, and I do want to get Marco's thoughts because he was listening live to it, about the status of Jalen Daniels going into the game against Oklahoma. Will he play? Well, the guys over at the Border Patrol had Lance Leipold, the head coach of the Kansas Jayhawks, on the show this morning. What did he say? We'll tell you next on ESPN Kansas City. We are back here on The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Well, Marco, as you know, is also a producer on the Border Patrol, and he takes the time to come over right after 4 hours of producing that and do this show. So his work is always appreciated here. And today was, I thought, maybe not a groundbreaking day, but definitely a very entertaining one, with the guys over the Border Patrol and Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati having the chance to sit down with Lance Leipold, the head coach of the Kansas Jayhawks. And coming off the bye week, I think everybody wants to know. Now, in the biggest game this season, and I know I said that for the Texas game, but once again, this is probably even bigger because Big Noon kickoff will be there. You're back in Lawrence. It's off the bye week. You've lost two games now, and you're hosting an undefeated Oklahoma team who is ranked top 10 in the nation. Well, the question everybody wants to know is Jalen Daniels going to play? Jalen Daniels has been out since the Texas game. And KU rolled into that one at 4-0. They've been 1-2 since. Their only win coming against UCF, in which they ran for 399 yards, won by 30 points. But I think everybody in the meantime has been going, all right, Jason Bean is not playing terribly. He wasn't great in the game against Texas, but he also found out 15 minutes before kickoff he was going to be the starting quarterback. Then I thought he was great against UCF, and I thought, aside from one really bad throw, was phenomenal against Oklahoma State. Defense was terrible in that game. But then you have the bye week, and I think everybody's going, all right, this has been a couple of weeks now. You had the bye week to rest up. Jalen Daniels has to play, right? I mean, unless this back injury, the back tightness flares up again, he should be ready to go, right? Well, the guys in the Border Patrol asked Lance Leipold, and he said point blank that it's likely that Jason Bean starts in this game. He's happy with the progression of Jalen Daniels, but he's just not ready to go. And I think part of me is going, is this a smokescreen? Now, what I mean by that of a smokescreen is, you know, are you trying to defer everybody's attention from Jalen Daniels and going, okay, don't even worry about him? And Oklahoma sees this, Brent Venables sees this, and goes, all right, let's start prepping for Jason Bean. But a part of me, listening to it today, goes, well, what advantage does Kansas gain in telling Oklahoma who their starter is on Tuesday? What advantage do you gain? No, if it were me, and I'm not a football coach, but if it were me, I'm making Oklahoma guess who's starting all week long. I'm going Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday saying, well, it's going to be a game-time decision. It just makes it a little bit tougher on Oklahoma. It's why for years we've seen coaches be tight-lipped about quarterback controversy, but we mostly see it in week one. If you have quarterback controversy, it's, well, it's going to be a game-time decision, so that your opponent has to plan for two quarterbacks. You have to prep for two guys. Now, if what Lance Leipold is saying is true, which I don't really have reason to doubt him, I don't think Lance Leipold is the type of coach to lie about things like that. But if that is true, then all right. Well, it's Jason Bean's the guy, and you just want to have a full week of prep, not even expecting Jalen to play. Because at the same time, if it is 100% true that he is a game-time decision, well, then what happens? Well, you have to work both the guys with the number ones. And then Jason Bean maybe doesn't get a full week of number one prep. He's got to watch Jalen Daniels take some snaps. And I know a lot of Kansas fans are frustrated. Now, Big Noon's there. It's a huge game. You feel much better about your chances with Jalen Daniels than you do Jason Bean. But here's what I would also argue. The season is not over if KU loses to Oklahoma. Okay, they're 5-3. I know that we contemplated, including myself, we contemplated, well, if they go in there and beat Texas, you're talking about a Big 12 championship appearance. Well, they didn't beat Texas. And then you thought, well, if they beat Oklahoma State after beating UCF, you're 6-1 going into Oklahoma. It is Big 12 title expectation if you beat Oklahoma. But when you lose to Oklahoma State, it takes a little bit of the power behind making that run. Now, I still think Kansas can have a very good season, and I'm sure that's what Lance Leipold and this coaching staff are thinking. We lose this game, well, we still got to go in there and get that sixth win somewhere. You have Iowa State, Texas Tech, Kansas State, and Cincinnati remaining. Three of those four, you should win. You lose any of those three games in Iowa State, Cincinnati, and Texas Tech, That's not a great loss on your schedule anymore. You lose to Kansas State, that's going to sting a lot. It'll probably be your worst loss in terms of losing to your rival, and that streak continues for the Cats and wins over Kansas. But K-State's likely going to be ranked at that point. It's, by definition, not a bad loss. And if you lose to Oklahoma and you lose to Kansas State and beat everybody else, you're 8-4. With all four of your losses coming against top-half teams in the Big 12. For Kansas football standards, that's not bad. That's really not. That would be your most wins in the regular season since 2007. Who knows if you finish ranked? I don't really know. I don't know what the top 25 is going to look like a couple weeks from now. But here's what I would say. That Kansas does need to prepare for the back half of the schedule. If I asked you right now, do you want to start Jalen Daniels the rest of the year at 70%? Or would you rather see Jalen Daniels 100% by the Texas Tech game? And he'll be 100% for Tech, K-State, and Cincinnati. What would you take? You get Jason Bean for Oklahoma and Iowa State. That's it. Now, if you go 1-1 in those games, you're 6-3. Jalen Daniels is back. You feel good about winning 8 and maybe 9 games if you found a way to upend Kansas State. But I just think that's the approach KU's taking, because we're so soon to forget that last year, I at least thought KU rushed Jalen Daniels back against Texas because they had just won, which felt weird because they had just won their 6th game. Now they're 6-3, and actually they might have been 6-4. I think they were 6-4 because they lost to Texas Tech the week before that, and they welcomed Texas. You already got bowl eligibility. And I would have thought, if you're saving Jalen Daniels for any game, save him for Kansas State and Manhattan. But he came back against Texas, and it was a damn good Texas team. We all know that. And he looked bad. He never looked comfortable. Just uneasy in the pocket. And that was a different injury. It was a shoulder injury, not a back injury. But was not good in the game. Kansas got trounced. We're down, I think, 31-0 at halftime of that game. And he wasn't great against Kansas State, and he wasn't great in the first half against Arkansas, the Liberty Bowl. But then, of course, we saw the old Jalen Daniels return in the second half, and that led us into all the momentum into 2023. So my take on it now is, if Jalen Daniels is 90%, is it worth it? Is it worth it to go throw him out there against Oklahoma? I would say at this point, after hearing Lance Leipold talk back-to-back days, it's not worth it. Because does Jalen Daniels at 90% give you a better chance to win than Jason Bean, especially with the way he played against Oklahoma State? I would say no, and I'm not willing to risk that injury over a loss that with Jalen Daniels or Jason Bean starting, you're not going to be favored in. Now, this isn't to go in and roll belly up here and say, okay, Oklahoma, it's our backup quarterback, feel free to thrash us in Lawrence. I don't think it's going to be like that. If you want my honest opinion, we'll break it down later in the week, but I think this is going to be like that TCU game on College Game Day. It's going to be very competitive start to finish, but likely at the end when you're asking for a game-winning drive or a drive to ice it, Oklahoma's going to have the upper hand. You know, 31-24 seems kind of likely. 38-31, something in that ballpark. I mean, Oklahoma's damn good. They're beatable. UCF just nearly knocked him off in Norman. I think UCF and Kansas, when UCF's fully healthy, are very comparable squads. Defense is hit and miss. Offensively, they can run all over you. So they showed a little bit of weakness, vulnerability last week against UCF. So I'm sure KU's looking at that and going, we still have a chance with Jason Bean. And if it wasn't for a defensive collapse against Oklahoma State and Stillwater, you win that football game. You win that football game with Jason Bean, and you're 2-1 with Bean as your quarterback. And 2-0, actually, 3-0 when he has a full week of prep, knowing he's a starting quarterback. Jason Bean is not the problem. He's not the problem going into this game. And for KU fans that are frustrated, I will urge you to look at the grand scheme of things here. Yes, it would be awesome to have Jalen Daniels at 100% in playing against Oklahoma. And if he is, if this is a smokescreen, great. 100% Jalen Daniels gives you a better chance to win against Oklahoma. But for what it sounds like, he's not yet. And maybe it's an injury that lingers all year long. And you know what? If he's never 100% again this season, then that's the chance you take. But I'm sure that the coaching staff is going, we have games that we need you in, absolutely need you in, at the tail end of the year. Yes, I would say they absolutely want him to be out there for Oklahoma. But if he's not 100%, there's no reason to put him out there. You lose against Oklahoma, it's not a bad loss. It's a team that could be competing for a Big 12 championship and a shot at the college football playoffs. Jason Bean right now, if he's 100% and Jalen's not, he's probably your best chance and your smartest chance moving forward. You know, Iowa State's going to be tough in Ames next weekend. If it meant that Jalen Daniels can start next week, if he sits out on Saturday and he can start against Iowa State, I'll take that. Now, you grab your sixth win then, you grab your seventh against Texas Tech, and then you welcome Kansas State when you're 7-3 and you have 100% Jalen Daniels. I'll take that. Now, don't get me wrong. I am frustrated that KU in a year like this started so well. They're ranked and they're going into Austin, and we haven't seen Jalen Daniels since because this damn back injury that won't seem to go away. I'm frustrated. I'm sure a lot of college football fans that like explosive offenses are a little bit let down that we don't see Jalen Daniels. But I urge everybody to look at Jason Bean and go, he's not the problem. No, he's not going to have those 95-yard game-winning drives, but not many quarterbacks can do that anyway. He was just fine against Oklahoma State. He was just fine against UCF. He was bad against Texas, but like I said, he found out 15 minutes before kickoff he was going to play. If KU loses to Oklahoma on Saturday, I am going to make the gambling bet that it's not going to be because of Jason Bean. If KU loses to Oklahoma on Saturday, it's likely because the defense can't get off the field. I think KU can score against Oklahoma. I think KU can run the football against Oklahoma. It's going to be a tough matchup, but KU at home this year has been phenomenal. They haven't played the toughest opponents. They've gotten Missouri State, Illinois, BYU, and UCF. But they've beaten every single one of those teams by double digits. They're a different team at home. It's going to be a rocking environment, big noon kickoff. I don't think the offense is going to be a problem. But if you're asking me what's the best route here, well, if Jalen Daniels is 100%, play him. If he's ready to go, play him. But I just, from what Lance Leipold has sounded like the last 2 days, it doesn't feel like he's 100%. He's progressing well, which is always a good sign. So then you start to look to the last half of the schedule. If you were to give me two options here, a red and a blue pill, and you said the red pill means Jalen Daniels is going to play this week, but I can't guarantee you what his health is going to be like the rest of the year. Okay, and the blue pill is he sits out against Oklahoma, he sits out against Iowa State, but he's 100% for Tech, Kansas State, and Cincinnati. I'm taking the blue pill. I'd rather have him 100% for the final three games and the bowl game than I would at him never getting 100% again, not playing well against Oklahoma, and then you have a quarterback problem for the rest of the year. And go back to Jason Bean and the rhythm's off. I don't want to see that. See if you can get it done with Jason Bean. And keep in mind, too, last 2 years, who's been the quarterback for Kansas against Oklahoma? It's been Jason Bean. And he lost barely at home in Lawrence when Oklahoma had the weird, you know, Caleb Williams grabbed the ball from a runner that had his forward progress stopped and fell forward, and they won by 12 points. And then last year, they won by 10 in Norman. Now, that game was more so garbage time points for Kansas than anything. It wasn't super close, but offensively, Jason Bean was fine. He moved the ball effectively, and I think he's going to move the ball effectively on Saturday. But it was a great interview done by the Border Patrol. Lance Leipold appears he's going to tell everybody now it's likely Bean starts, but you never know. Maybe it's a smokescreen. Maybe all I just said doesn't matter because JD's going to play on Saturday. But I would say right now, it just feels like he's going to get another week of rest. And you're wanting him 100% for the back half rather than rushing him back at 80 to 90%, if he even is to 80 or 90%. Maybe he's 75. Who really knows? The only guy that knows right now is Jalen Daniels. All right, before we wrap up the show, Marco, I mean, you were there for that interview. You're listening to Nate and Steven conduct that interview. You know, it feels like, oh, this is going to be the Jason Bean show on Saturday, but I'm going to put you in the shoes of Lance Leipold, and you are going to look at, you know, this quarterback situation going into Oklahoma. If Jalen Daniels is 90% on Saturday, do you go ahead and start him, or do you say, let's wait one more week? We like where Jason Bean is at. We like the way he's played. we feel like we still have a chance against Oklahoma with our backup quarterback? Or do you go, I am going all cards on the table here. I want Jalen Daniels out there because he's the only way Kansas beats Oklahoma. So which path are you taking here? Rest Jalen Daniels another week, or do you try to rush him back against Oklahoma?
90%.
90%.
I'm putting him in and starting him against Oklahoma, and then seeing how that transpires before going with Jason Bean. It's funny you asked me that because before, during the break when you were getting ready to go into this segment, I had been thinking, you know, if Jalen Daniels is around 80%, if he can go out there on the field and he can get through warmups, unlike he was able to do against Texas, which is why he was, which what ended up getting him pulled that day, I think that you need to roll with it. And if he's comfortable with it too, it's got to be both sides are wanting to go with it as well. Then I'd say you go through with him because he is. I just think that you can go off of the game plan. I want to say there may already be a game plan, maybe not working on the practice field, but mentally getting him prepared if he is ready to go on Saturday. Then there is some type of format or plan to follow. But also, again, you get the week-long work in with the bye week, too, with Jason Bean. He's there to be put in if Daniels needs to be if you need to pull Daniels in that game. So that's why I'd run with Jalen first, because Jason is there as well prepared. And he was the quarterback in the game last year, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's got experience out there. I'm not worried about Jason Bean not being ready because now he's gotten more games under his belt. I mean, now that I think about it, I believe he's played and started more games than Jalen Daniels this year. I believe Jalen Daniels has only started against Illinois, against Nevada, and against BYU. Jason Bean has Missouri State. He's got Texas, UCF, and he had Oklahoma State. So this will be his fifth start of the year. Jalen Daniels only has three, so I'm not worried about him being ready to go. But it's an interesting case. You know, I just threw it out there 90%. Who knows where he's at? He could be 60, 65%. Maybe for Kansas fans, he is closer to 90%. I'm sure that Jalen Daniels is just itching to play. I'm sure that he wants to be out there more than anything, but this kind of feels like a training staff type of thing. Now, the training staff could be going, we screwed up this whole injury early on in the year, because think about it. Was Jason Bean a good enough quarterback to win you that game against Illinois, to win you that game against Nevada, to win you that game against BYU? I don't know. I mean, we saw against Missouri State just fine, UCF just fine. Did Jalen Daniels give them the edge against Nevada, against Illinois, against BYU? I would say he certainly had some pull there. But what happened if Jalen Daniels sits out the first four games of the year and then he's ready to go for Texas? We'll never know. And so I'm sure the training staff is a bit gun-shy going, well, if we rush him back again and then it flares up against Iowa State and he's out for the year, then we look like fools because that's twice they've mishandled that injury just a little bit. But we'll see. Still a couple of days to go before Big Noon kickoff on Saturday in Lawrence, Kansas for Oklahoma and Kansas. There is Ray Charles, so it's time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We will talk to you tomorrow at 10 a.m. You take it easy, Kansas City.